This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Friday at the end of an obviously not great week. We, however, are going to begin with where things stand in this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, as I said, the 16th of February. This one is glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. I will just note here as we get going that on Monday morning when we all woke up, we thought it was going to be Infrastructure Week, the third one, I think, maybe the fourth. 5 days later, things look a lot different for a whole lot of reasons. We are going to talk about what happened in business and the economy and what it means with Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, also Neela Richardson from Redfin. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Neela, let me start with you, I want to go back a little bit to the jobs report that we got a week, 10 days ago, showing wages going up and everybody kind of freaking out a little bit about inflation, and then we got CPI and people were freaked out about inflation more. Are we worrying too much about the prospect of rising prices in this economy?
Yes, we are. And we're seeing 1 month of really positive news on the wage front. And we're saying that that's a trend in terms of inflation. But we need to see many more months of wage increases to really see an overheating of the economy. And the reaction by the stock market was really compelling. I mean, huge drops on the fear of rising rates, that the Fed would have to cool down the economy and take away the punch bowl. That just is more evidence that the economy is not the stock market and vice versa. And we still need to see more wage growth before there's any fear of the kind of inflation that would prompt a stock market correction like we saw earlier.
Right. So fair enough. And yes, the stock market was overbought. But Catherine, let me pick up on something Neela said and have you spin it out. This idea that the Fed now is going to raise rates more precipitously than they might have in the coming like year, 18 months. We are going to be borrowing a lot of money in this economy over the next 8 to 10 years. And yet both Gary Cohn, the president's chief economic advisor, the head of the National Economic Council, and Kevin Hassett, the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors in the White House, basically said this week, deficits, meh, what? Help me understand that.
Yeah, there are a few things to unpack there. One is that suddenly there seems to be this fiscal flip-flop right within the Republican Party, of course, that they used to be very concerned about deficits, now they're not. But it's not only the hypocrisy that I think we should be talking mm-hmm. about, and there's been lots of commentary yep. about that. It's the timing of this reversal, right? When we heard a lot of concerns about deficits from Republicans was mostly when Barack Obama was in office, yes, but also shortly after the Great Recession, after the financial crisis, right, when you could make an argument that there was a good reason to be running up our debt because the economy needed it. Today is a completely different situation in that we have unemployment at 4.1%. You know, the economy has been doing well. We're in right now one of the longest recoveries on record. And so to be expanding our deficits now, to be running up debt now, is a completely different situation, and that suggests that maybe it is less called for, that the timing of this reversal, in other words, this policy reversal, is right, a little bit inopportune.
Neela, let me ask you then, what is going on here? Because Mick Mulvaney, when he was in now the director of the Office of Management and Budget, when he was in Congress, was a huge deficit hawk. He comes out and stands before reporters and says, you know, points for candor. He said, listen, I can't honestly tell you with a straight face this budget is going to balance. But he now is presiding over a budget that has $1 trillion in deficits annually in years to come. What is going on?
a very awkward dance for political reasons. Look, the Republicans have promised many things, but one thing they are set on is 3% economic growth. And at a time when the Fed is trying to slow the economy down by raising short-term rates, the Republican Party has decided to throw kerosene on the economy and in hopes to getting this 3%. That means you have to set aside your beliefs about deficits and fiscal balance and focus on growth and growth alone at all costs. And we're paying those costs in the form of trillion-dollar deficits. So Mulvaney is part of this awkward dance that the Republicans are doing, trading off fiscal discipline for economic growth at 3%.
Catherine, let me ask you to riff on that for a second, a little bit on the idea of growth. And I want to frame it this way. The immigration deals that the Senate was working on collapsed yesterday. There were four of them. That means we're not going to get DACA. We're not going to get a wall. But it does seem clear that what the president is looking for, based on his comments, is some kind of restriction of legal immigration. Now, we have an economy at full employment. He wants to cut the number of immigrants in this economy. Talk to me about growth and how we get there with that.
I think it will be very, very challenging. We already have major demographic drag on growth. I mean, part of the reason why we have forecasts for growth going forward that's lower than it has been, you know, over the last, let's say, 40 years, is that you have baby boomers who are retiring, who are leaving the workforce. And that means that there won't be as many people, adding their productive capacity to the economy, which is an argument potentially for finding other ways to grow the workforce, i.e., immigration. If you are further cutting levels of legal immigration, that means that you're going to have fewer working age people in the economy, because immigrants tend to be working age, legal or illegal, whether they're here, whatever their paper situation is.
Right.
So I think if the White House is really interested in juicing growth, having this kind of tax cut will juice growth a little bit in the near term, but not in the long term. In the long term, you need to think about things like the size of the workforce, the skill set of the workforce, and how do you get the economy growing based on the human capital that's here.
Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post, Neela Richardson at Redfin on a Friday in this economy. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. A little bumpy on Wall Street today. Traders did step back a little bit after those indictments from Special Counsel Robert Mueller. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We pause now for a brief detour into the American housing market, whence can come much joy or much macroeconomic sadness. If you're on the bandwagon of stronger growth to come this year, today's report on new home construction is good news. The government told us that housing starts, as they are called, were up 9.7% in January. That's over December. It's their second highest level since the post-recession recovery did start in American housing. Single-family groundbreaking was strong. Even stronger were multifamily units, rental apartments and condos, which is, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman will explain here, kind of the economic cherry on top.
A lot of people are rooting for more home building. Buyers who want more supply and might see a slowdown in home price inflation, and renters who could benefit from more rental units on the market. Christopher Mayer is at Columbia Business School.
The challenge has been affordability for lots of people. Construction has still not been focused as much on entry level. A lot of new construction has been the middle to higher end of the market.
The people who have typically moved into entry-level homes aren't shacking up as much, says Ben Herzon at IHS Market.
The rate at which these young adults are forming households is declining, contributing to a less robust recovery in the housing market.
There are small signs of progress on affordability. The typical new home is slightly smaller, and more townhouses are going in, says Robert Dietz at the National Association of Home Builders.
Townhouses use a little bit less land and can serve as a useful bridge between rentership and homeownership.
And there's already been a boom in multifamily construction, which is helping renters, says Sydney Bennett at Apartment List.
Some of these cities that had some of the fastest rent growth, Portland, Denver, Seattle, same with San Francisco or New York, have seen that slow down a bit.
But it will likely take several years of robust home and apartment construction to moderate the rapid inflation in housing costs we've seen lately. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You know, and I've heard all the storm and drong about online commerce demolishing brick-and-mortar retail, right? Yes, it is an issue, but hold your horses here just one second, because there is a growing trend of online-first retailers starting to expand their physical footprints. Amazon is doing it, as you might have heard. Also, Warby Parker, which first began selling eyeglasses online, now plans to have almost 100 stores across the country by the end of the year. Marketplace's Rima Crace explains why and how retailers like Warby are making that transition.
Everlane, Casper, UnTucket, those are just three among the dozens of online-first brands getting physical, trying to lure in more customers.
There are people that, in buying different types of things, want the tactile experience of actually seeing the product itself.
You know, to touch that yellow dress you've been eyeing for months online. Brian Gildenberg at Kantar Retail says, but more than that, the stores are meant to serve as flagships for the online brands.
A number of brands are trying to think about how they use the store as more experience center and then sell enough in it to, you know, basically offset the cost of creating that brand experience.
And in some cases, he says, stores aren't even selling stuff. They're just providing experts to help customers shop online. Karen Herman is with Gusty Creative. She says increasingly, real estate developers are offering brands flexible leases that allow them to experiment.
To start with a pop-up or start with a short-term lease and really groom their customers and groom the market space for their product or service.
And online-first retailers have the means to do that in a smart way, says Melissa Gonzalez. She's the founder of the Lioness Group, which helps online companies go physical.
The good thing about digital natives, right, is they have data already. So we always ask them to kind of do the exercise of where is the most of your traffic coming from today?
Where do your customers live?
What are they looking at the most?
What are they not looking at? She says opening a physical store is expensive. It can cost up to $500,000 just for a pop-up. So the challenge is to curate products in the right way to make the offline feel like the online. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
You want to be healthy, you got to eat right and get some exercise. That is the classic formula you'll hear from your doctor. Companies, though, have started getting in on the action as well with those corporate wellness programs, the idea being that healthy employees are more productive. Also, they have lower medical bills, so they are healthy for the company's bottom line. Now, are those programs actually worth the money that companies spend on them? That, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, is a whole nother question.
Robert Granger stands on a thick blue padded mat and stares up at a rock climbing wall covered in rainbow-colored hand and footholds. Like somebody threw a bunch of Skittles against the wall and they stuck.
So I'm going to check out a few of the boulder problems.
Problems are climbing lingo for roots up a wall.
Maybe do some of the easier ones I've done before to warm up.
Granger's at a climbing gym called The Cliffs in Queens, New York. He picks out a path marked in bright purple and starts climbing.
Thinking, reaching.
In about a minute, he taps both hands at the top of the wall and starts climbing back down. Rest, pick a new route, repeat.
Yeah, it's a really good place to unwind and think about something else.
Membership here is pretty pricey. Granger pays about $1,200 a year, but his company picks up nearly half, $500, as part of its corporate wellness program. Damon Jones, a health policy researcher at the University of Chicago, says between 2011 and 2016, workplace wellness spending increased from about $1 billion to more than $8 billion.
So the goal is to hopefully improve employees' health, lower their health costs, and possibly increase their productivity.
The more structured programs might start with a health screening and risk assessment, and then try and incentivize the employee to be healthier, maybe by giving them rewards if they hit certain exercise goals. Jones actually joined one of these programs when he was a postdoctoral student.
My reason for signing up for a wellness program was that I had already been going to the gym, and I was happy to be given a reward for doing so.
So that got him thinking, do these programs actually work to change people's behavior, or mostly reward people like him for stuff they're already doing? Fast forward a few years, and he created a study to find out. Participants at the University of Illinois were randomly assigned to a group that could opt into a wellness program and a control group that couldn't. The first question, who would join the wellness program given the option?
They tend to be healthier. They're more likely to go to the gym or run in a local 10K or 5K or half marathon. They tend to be lower spenders in terms of healthcare spending.
So second question, given that self-selection, did joining a wellness program make a difference compared with the control group?
We could see your health spending with your insurer, We could see how many times you went to the gym. And then we also had a survey where we asked people about their health. We measured almost 40 outcomes, and we mostly didn't find any difference between those two groups.
No difference. So the idea that these wellness programs might change employee behavior or cut their healthcare spending, at least in the short term, Jones says neither has panned out. But he says the study did find one positive.
We did find people were more likely to say that their manager or their employer cared about their health and safety.
And that's something climber Robert Granger told me about his company, a consulting firm called Actualize. He said he'd go to the climbing gym whether or not his company chipped in for it. But the fact that the company does makes him feel like it's invested in his health. Carrie Weckelow is the managing director of HR and operations at Actualize. She plans quarterly wellness challenges on top of the $500 wellness allowance the company gives employees. Last year, Actualize spent $17,000 on these programs.
Well, we feel that it helps with our retention. The average tenure is 8 years at Actualize.
She says more than 65% of employees participate in the quarterly challenges, and that she thinks they help with team building and communication as well. But one area she hasn't really seen a change, the company's healthcare spending. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Lizzie O'Leary and the gang at our weekend show did a whole hour about the business of health and wellness. Best way to hear it is to subscribe to Marketplace Weekend in your podcast app, oh choice. Coming up.
We ran from school today. Right as we got out of school, we sprinted here. It's unimaginably fun.
Watching people play video games. You laugh, but it's a billion-dollar business, people. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 19 points on this Friday, less than a 10%, 25,219. NASDAQ down 16 points, about 0.2%, closed at 7,239. The S&P 500 gained 1 point. One single solitary point. We're going to call that flat. 27 and 32. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow added 4.25%. NASDAQ grew 5.3%. S&P 500 advanced 4.3%. Tech stocks turned higher today. Alphabet, a.k.a. Google, advanced 0.3%. Applied Materials rustled up 1.9% today. Micron Technology clicked up 1.6%. Bond prices, why they rose. Thanks for asking. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.87%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We told you yesterday about how the European Union is as a whole growing economically at its fastest pace in a decade. Italy, you go ahead and take one step backward. The Italian economy is the same size today as it was in the year 2000, almost 20 years of net GDP growth of zero. There is a general election in Italy next month, one key issue in which is going to be youth unemployment, right now at about 30%. One company has started offering bus rides to get applicants to job interviews and exams across the country. The BBC's James Reynolds followed a group of nurses competing for one single job.
It's 12:30, and we've just set off. Our journey, rattling through the country, is going to last about 6.5 hours.
My name is Eugenio. I'm 26, and I've been unemployed for the past 3 months. I made a lot of sacrifices at university, but always find myself starting again from zero.
The young man sitting behind the driver is the person who created this scheme of getting job candidates from across Italy to their interviews, to their exams.
I'm Raffaele. I'm 26. I'm one of the founders of Bus2Go Italia. This job was born out of necessity. Unemployment is high and there aren't enough jobs.
It's now 3:00 in the morning. Generally, this is a really bad time to be awake, the kind of time where your worst fears hit you.
My name is Felicia. I'm 24, and I'm a nurse. I'm stuck getting by on short-term jobs. I'm living a day-to-day existence. That makes it hard for me to plan a future, to think about buying a home and starting a family.
My name is Luigi, and I'm 27.
It is very difficult for those of us from southern Italy. The people who get ahead are those who have connections.
It's just after 7 in the morning. The sky is grey, and we have now arrived in the town of Foligno in central Italy. And the people around me on the bus now have to prepare to take the exam. The candidates from the bus now join what? There must be 200 people here outside the military barracks where the exam will be held, providing a certain amount of foreboding and discipline to what is probably already a reasonably terrifying experience. And it is astonishing to think that of all the people I can see around me, only one person will be guaranteed a contract. The exam only takes 45 minutes. It's an awful long way to come for such a short test. And now candidates are coming out in dribs and drabs. And let's see what they made of it.
Com'è andato?
I think it went well, but it could have been better.
I'm relieved. I have a headache, but on we go.
And they look pretty shattered. And unless one of them has managed to beat off the hundreds of other candidates, it is incredibly likely that they will all have to get back on this bus in the next few weeks and months and all head off once again in search of a single job.
The BBC's James Reynolds for us. Now, here's something the video game market research company Superdata says about 2.5 billion people, that is 1 in 3 human beings alive right now, play video games either on their computers or their phones. Correspondingly, the idea of esports, that is competitive video game playing, has exploded over the past couple of decades. It is now a billion-dollar business where fans can go and watch professional gamers compete against each other in big auditoriums. It's like going to a baseball game, kinda. Marketplace's Andy Euler went to get a sense of what's going on.
At the Blizzard Arena in Burbank, California, lots of young people sit staring at a massive video screen overhead. They're watching two teams of 6 professional players battle each other in a video game called Overwatch. The players direct online heroes who must save their world from chaos. It's loud, and camera angles are fast and unsettling. but the audience follows it seamlessly. Most don't know or even care that they're sitting in the very soundstage where Johnny Carson and Jay Leno filmed The Tonight Show for more than 40 years. They're totally consumed with what's happening on stage.
We actually drove like 19 hours to get here. Straight, like one or two stops for gas, that's about it.
Devin Reynolds and a few friends drove down from Seattle and just got into town. Reynolds plays Overwatch a lot. He's 20 and studying psychology in college, but says he really wants to be a professional esports player.
That's eventually the goal. Like, I'm working on like coaching / playing for a team, working our way up. So this is a great experience. Get to see how the players interact and how much they're talking, which players talk the most, things like that is very interesting to like see for me.
Interesting to Reynolds and his friends, but they play the game. They're super fans. But what's the wider business model for the Overwatch League? Scott Johnson, who produces a podcast about esports, says it's a lot different from that of traditional sports.
Everything's kind of flipped in a weird way, and the end game, therefore, is a little murky.
NFL franchises, for example, make big bucks, more than half of their revenue from TV deals, not so much from building and maintaining stadiums. Activision Blizzard, the company that owns Overwatch, calls itself an entertainment company, but at its core, it's a video game producer. Scott Johnson says the folks at Blizzard just need to keep selling games.
And they need to have players keep getting excited about this game. In Blizzard's mind, that's all you need to be a big cash generator for pretty infinite amount of time.
10 million people around the world watched the first week of the Overwatch League online. So Overwatch already has a captive audience, and Blizzard's already monetized ads for those live streams. For a video game competition, the in-person experience seems secondary.
Blizzard is deciding to take this way further, and as a result, they're putting way more on the line, including buying their own arena, and they're trying to make this as big and as mainstream as possible.
These days, all the Overwatch games are played in Burbank, but the plan is that the games will be played in the 12 franchise cities, like in traditional sports. Nate Nanzer is the commissioner of the Overwatch League.
If you're a local auto dealer, you have no reason to sponsor a global esport league. But if there's a team in Dallas, a team in Houston, a team in Boston, like, you actually might have a reason to get involved.
Lots of us dreamed of playing professional sports, quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys or center fielder for the Yankees. Some kids still have those dreams, but many others, like 16-year-old Tyler McCormick, thinks esports are the future.
Me and my friend Adrian is down there. We ran from school today. Right as we got out of school, we sprinted here. It's unimaginably fun.
You could argue that esports are already mainstream in places like China and South Korea. Here in the U.S., big names like Robert Kraft, who owns the New England Patriots, and Stan Kroenke, who owns the L.A. Rams, have invested in teams. Take me out to the video game, anyone? I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the business and economic equivalent of those surveys showing only 4% of Americans can find Russia on a map or something. Last night on HQ Trivia, the interactive game app, one of the questions was, what is the official currency of China? There were, according to Bloomberg, 857,623 people playing at that moment. The choices presented were renminbi, yen, and Chinese dollar. 720,000 people said yen, which is, do I have to tell you, the Japanese currency. Renminbi is the right answer, although that's slang, because in defense of those who got it wrong, the official Chinese currency is called the yuan. The renminbi is kind of the nickname, actually. Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. Markets today, flatty, flat, 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 up for the week, 4-5% across the board. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Our executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Evelyn LaRubia is the executive editor. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.